headquarters, December 14, 1776. The campaign having closed with the pursuit of the enemy's army near 90 miles by Lieutenant General Cornwallis's corps, much to the honor of his lordship and his officers and soldiers under his command, the approach of winter putting a stop to any further progress, the troops will immediately march into quarters and hold themselves in readiness to assemble on the shortest notice. General William Howe. This is episode 65, The Christmas Crossing. And I do find it kind of fortuitous. My delays with my busy schedule have actually brought me right to Christmas time. And we are landing perfectly with Christmas time to do an episode about Washington crossing the Delaware. And that's where we're going to pick up things this week. Now, I do promise that hopefully this week is very productive in the sense that I can get several episodes written out, and I can record them hopefully all at once, but if not, record them at a timely fashion where I can have several episodes ready to go. But, you know, that's just wishful thinking. Unfortunately, my busy schedule precludes me from keeping pace with all of my responsibilities. But as you know, the saying goes, the show must go on, and this show will continue to go on as often as I can do it. So I want to thank everyone for bearing with me, and for those loyal listeners. I'm still getting Facebook messages every so often about people who have caught up on all the episodes. They think everything is great. They're very complimentary. So I want to thank everyone for those kind words that you guys give to me, because it really helps boost my morale and really gives me that drive and push to keep doing what I'm doing. So the quote that I opened with was Howe's official closing of the campaign season of 1776, at least for the British Army. Now, Howe would order most of his army to return to New York City, but they had all these loyal citizens in New Jersey, and he wanted to make sure they were protected. So he set up a line of outposts to protect against any potential attacks or raids by the rebels. They were located at Amboy, New Brunswick, and Princeton. Cornwallis would be overall field commander, but along the Delaware from Bordentown to Burlington, a German commander, Colonel von Dunup, would be in command of 3,000 men, a combination of Hessian Grenadiers, Jaegers, and the 42nd Highlanders. These men were to guard the immediate front along the Delaware River where Washington had crossed. Von Dunup would station his men at Trenton, and the other half would be at Bordentown. They were roughly 6 miles apart, but as the way Von Dunup sees it, he didn't believe that the rebels would even try such a crossing, so he thought that keeping the men out in the cold was something that was an unnecessary risk to take, I should say. The whole line itself from Staten Island to Trenton was about 80 miles long. Now, even in the 1700s, this is a risky move. Those garrisons could be easily cut off and surrounded. But Howe knew the enemy strength of Washington was around 6,000 men, and half of those were going to see their enlistments expire at the end of the year anyway, so he had reason to believe that his position was secure. In mid-December, Washington began to contemplate the idea of making a crossing and moving against the British outposts. Now, this was not an easy decision to make. If he makes the crossing and it fails, then he's risking his entire army. They would not be easily able to escape over the river like they did the last time. And if, you know, they are attacked and defeated, that's damage to the morale of the army and the cause that would be catastrophic. But it's finally decided that they're going to make a crossing. And on Christmas Eve, 1776, the Continentals are going to cross the Delaware and go after their main objective, which is the town of Trenton. Now, the crossing was going to take place in three separate divisions. These three divisions are going to do it at three separate locations. The first division was under the command of Brigadier General John Cadwalder. He would have a total of about 1,900 men. Now, 900 of these were Hitchcock's Rhode Island Continentals, but the other 1,000 were the Pennsylvania Associators. We had talked about them in a previous episode. These were almost like the Pennsylvania version of the Minutemen. And then they would also have Captain Tom Rooney's company of Delaware militia and 2 artillery companies armed with 1 6-pounder apiece. Now, they were going to attack, or they were going to cross, I should say, at Bristol. And what they're going to do is they're going to engage Dunnop's forces at Mount Holly to keep their attention. The 2nd Division, under Brigadier General James Ewing, made up of Pennsylvania and New Jersey militia, about 700 in all, will cross at Trenton Ferry, take the position south of Assunpink Creek, and hold the bridge over the stream in case the Hessians try to retreat that way. The 3rd Division, under the command of George Washington, was going to be the attacking division. Now, this 2nd Division was the largest. It would consist of about 2,400 men selected from the brigades of Stephen, Mercer, Sterling, Sinclair, Glover, Sargent, and Roche de Fermoy. Each brigade commander was in charge of his own men. The division would be split into 2 corps. The men, the 1st Corps would be under the command of Green, the 2nd would be under the command of Sullivan. Now, they would cross the McConkie's Ferry about 9 miles north of Trenton. They would take the roads leading into town, and at the appointed time, Washington would order the men to attack the town and hopefully take it with very little casualties. Also accompanying Washington would be Colonel Henry Knox with 18 field pieces. Now, before they set off, the men were ordered to carry 3 days of rations and about 40 rounds of ammunition. Now, that is actually quite a substantial number. The average cartridge box at the time only carried about 25 rounds. So, depending, you know, and that was depending on your cartridge box. They didn't have standard issue cartridge boxes like the British. But to carry 40 rounds of ammunition, they knew that they were going to be in for a bit of a scrap. Washington hoped that if he could take Trenton, then the army would be able to gather its forces and move against the British posts at Princeton and New Brunswick. At 3 in the afternoon on Christmas Day, the main division was assembled at McConkie's Ferry and was preparing to load the boats. At dark, they began loading the troops and crossing the Delaware. Now, the first to cross were the Virginia Continentals under General Stephen. The crossing was slow because the river was full of huge hunks of ice, and they had to be maneuvered around. But once Stephen is across, Mercer has the second wave, and his Continentals are a bit of a mixed bag. They come from Connecticut, Maryland, and Massachusetts, so a very broad spectrum of Continentals, I'll say. The third wave would be Sterling's Corps. He would have 2 regiments of Virginia Continentals, along with Hazlitt's Delawares, and a regiment of Pennsylvania Riflemen. Now, these three corps would be making up the left wing under Green. The attacking forces would be Mercer and Stephen, with Sterling being held in reserve. The right wing was under the command, as I had said, of Sullivan. And all of the men in his corps would be pulled from his own division, from the regiments of Sinclair, Glover, and Sargent. Roche de Fermoy would also be a part of it, but he would take 2 regiments in advance. His regiments were actually a regiment of German soldiers and 1 of a Pennsylvania militia. Now, the crossing, as I had said, was difficult, and to only make matters worse, it was a dark night. The moon was covered by clouds. It was cold. There was hail, sleet, everything that you could possibly think to make your crossing open water difficult was happening. Now, the plan was for the army to get across by midnight. Then they would have about 5 hours of cover, 5 hours of darkness, to cover the 9 miles to Trenton. They hope to be in position by sunup so that they can make their assault. The problem was, it would be about 3 a.m. by the time the last man was off the boat, and about 4 a.m. by the time the entire army was underway and moving. An even bigger problem is the men are not well dressed for this type of weather. It's an unfortunate norm that we have talked about on several occasions that the men of the Continental Army are underdressed and without shoes. And I don't know how many times I've talked about commanders like Washington, Schuyler, even Artemus Ward back in the early days, calling for supplies for these troops. They needed footwear, they needed warm clothes, and they just weren't getting it. And one of a more grisly description that we'll get is one soldier talking about how the march through the snow, you would see the grisly bloody footprints that mark the path of the army. Now, as unfortunate as it is to talk about men that are underdressed and without proper footwear, these were hardy men, strong men, and they do make their march, and they do it with pride because they knew that with Washington at the helm, that, well, who knows, they could possibly do anything. It always was unique to me how he could inspire his men so. And this was a man that as a field commander lost more battles than he won. You know, when you think about more modern day commanders, you think about Montgomery from the Brits during World War II, or Patton and their feud, and how they inspired their men through sheer tenacity and vigor, but they won a lot of battles. You know, Norman Schwarzkopf, one of the, you know, more famous generals of the 20th and 21st century, is a man that, you know, went into a fight and won. I mean, and you can look at generals and heroes across time, Napoleon, Alexander the Great, I mean, Doug MacArthur. I can sit here and name about 50 commanders that are well known on the battlefield, and it was through their prowess and their sheer will to win a victory that they are followed. But it's Washington's love of his men and the passion for the patriot cause that flock men to him. A man that wins very few battles in the American Revolution and even less during the French and Indian War. Heck, he even started the French and Indian War. Let's, you know, call a spade a spade. But this man inspired his men. And though it is grisly to think about that these men would walk through the snow barefoot with their feet bleeding, most likely frostbitten, and then go into a battle, is something that has to be admired. But that's my soapbox moment for the day. The army would make their march, and we will talk about next time them getting into position. But before I end the episode for this week, I actually want to talk about, just shortly, what Trenton looks like. The garrison in Trenton is three regiments under the command of Rahl, Knappenhausen, and Lossberg. They also have 50 German Jägers, along with 20 light dragoons, about 1,400 men in all. They'll also have a complement of 6 3-pound cannons. Now, Knappenhausen, we've talked about before, and we have definitely heard the name Rahl before. But for those that need the refresher, Colonel Johann Gottlieb Rahl was in command. We've talked about his regiment before. We've seen them lead the flank attack at Chatterton's Hill in White Plains. He was one of the commanders that would force the surrender of Fort Washington in New York. So this man was definitely accustomed to facing off with Washington's army and was not a commander that was going to be easily pushed over. Now, Trenton itself was a town that had two parallel streets that ran north and south. They were King and Queen Street. They were intersected by Front Street, 2nd Street, and 3rd Street, and those would run east and west. Now, the town itself had no natural defenses except for the fact that the Delaware River was to the west of it. And when the other officers would ask Rahl to put up defenses, Rahl, the proud German that he is, just scoffs. Let them come. Nothing but a lot of farmers. We want no trenches. We'll at them with the bayonet. This is a sentiment that, of course, is seconded by General James Grant, who was in command of the British troops in New Jersey at the time. Remember, this is the same General James Grant that all those many months ago boasted that he could march through the entire colony with 5,000 men. Now, it's been many months, and many battles have been fought since then. And I'll tell you right now, if Grant was given the option to march through the Americas, or the American colonies, I should say, with 5,000 men, he surely would have gotten his butt handed to him several times over. It's been proven that Howe has had to very much so use the extent of his 25,000 men, or 20,000 men, to make his point in pushing Washington around. Washington is not going to roll over. And as we will talk about next time, Rahl, Cornwallis, and Grant will most surely be shocked and a little bit surprised when they see what Washington has up his sleeve. So that's going to do it for this episode. Hopefully the plan will be to have another episode right after Christmas. So I want to wish everyone a happy holiday, happy and safe holiday. And I will definitely be returning next week with the Battle of Trenton. I hopefully can get it out on the 26th because historically that was actually when the battle was fought. But that's wishful thinking, seeing as how the holidays are always a hectic time, especially in the in my household. But anyway, once again, I thank everyone for their support. And if you want to show your support a little bit more and you're an iTunes downloader, please go to iTunes. Give me a 5-star review. It's definitely much appreciated. So till next time, everyone have a great week and a great Christmas. And as always, keep that powder dry.